Are there any comments that you might have concerning this whole Democratic Convention incident that you would have liked to have testified to but were unable to do so?
I would have liked to testify in an altogether different manner, which is, I think, after all, you're having eight men, seven in this courtroom, being tried for on very serious charges, and if they're found guilty, they can get 5 or 10 years. And what's involved is what were the subtle motivations of their brain. And I was forced in testimony, as I imagine all the other witnesses have been, to answer ridiculously low-level yes and no questions. For example, at one point, when the question was whether Mr. Rubin had said that we will intimidate the establishment. And I was trying to recollect, not whether he literally used that word. In other words, I was summarizing a conversation with him when I said, if I did say, that he had said that it was intimidating the establishment. What I'm getting at is that we talked for hours. The judge then insists that it all be boiled down, or the prosecuting attorney insists be boiled down to a few words and phrases. It doesn't work like that. The human process that's involved is altogether different. People, if they're talking about conspiracy, the question is what the intent is, what the natural desire is of the people who are planning a move. Are they together or are they apart? Are they conspiring or are they not conspiring? The gist of my testimony was that it was a curious conspiracy when these people weren't even in contact with one another. In other words, the part I found most frustrating in testifying was I couldn't testify to the main point I had to give today. And my objection to the procedure in the court is simply that if you are trying people for conspiracy, my God, that's a serious charge. It's a particularly dubious matter. The very law on this matter of conspiracy is terribly difficult and tenuous. And the least that one's entitled to is to go in for a great deal of exploration on what the nature of political philosophy is and what the relation of political philosophy to action is, rather than to get a whole series of yes and no questions and did he literally say this word or didn't he? It's not an accident case.
How do you view this trial, just in general, Mr. Miller? What is your...
Well, I've only been here one day, so I don't feel I'm an expert on it.
From your readings and from your...
Well, I'd have to trust in what I read that you guys write in the papers.
The whole concept of the trial.
Oh, I think it's a ugly trial. You know, I'm on record as saying that I think Chicago's a great city. I think Chicago's the greatest remaining American city, and I love Chicago. The few times I've been here, coming from Brooklyn, I love it particularly because it's sort of like Brooklyn with a top hat. But I think that the events in August 1968 were the shame of Chicago, and I think if Chicago had any sense, they would have done everything they could have to have forgotten this conspiracy. I think this is just, I could hardly never prove this, but it seems to me that this case ultimately represents the fact that Mayor Daley will not admit to himself that the reason Richard Nixon's in the White House is because his policeman ran amok in Chicago in August 68.
Okay. Mr. Mailer, after the Pentagon demonstrations and after your conversations with Rubin and others, was there some question in your mind then as to whether they were coming to Chicago, or is there a question in your mind today as to whether they came to Chicago with the intention of inciting a riot?
I don't think they came to Chicago with the intention of inciting a riot. I think that they're reasonably tough men with a lot of imagination, and they knew they were heading into a very difficult situation. But I think they understand, what I admire them for is that they have an understanding of power relations and the way the establishment works in America that I found was deeper than my own. In other words, what shocked me about Chicago in 68 is I always had given the establishment more credit. You know, I always felt that it ran things better than it actually did run them. I was amazed at how quickly the establishment cracked up under that pressure. Because finally, what was it? There were 12,000 kids not given a permit to march and just being beaten day after day after day, and these kids kept coming back and getting beaten again and again and again, and they finally functioned like very good soldiers. I mean, they had a morale and a spree that was really fantastic, because all they were getting for their pains were beatings, and it wasn't even a formal war or anything. And the police department of the city, which is not, after all, the worst police department in the world, there are many police departments, which are far worse than Chicago's, this police department finally cracked up over here. And what I'm getting at is I think that these men had a sense, each independently, by the way, because anybody who knows anything about left-wing politics knows that the hardest thing in the world is to conceive of a conspiracy. You know, for instance, when we were talking about the moonshot, some people were going around making a joke and saying, well, you know, maybe it all took place in a television studio. And so naturally, you know, you want to entertain every hypothesis and think about it. And I decided that, sure, they could have done it in a movie studio, but you could never get enough people to keep the secret. And that's why we had to know they did go to the moon, because you just couldn't get 500 men to keep that sort of secret. that the moonshot took place in a television studio never happened. Well, by the same token, anyone knows anything about left-wing politics knows that left-wingers are incapable of conspiring because they're all egomaniacs. They just don't work with each other. Why do you think that the center runs the country? It's because they can cooperate with each other.
The defendants have concluded, Mr. Mailer, that Mayor Daley actually was the perpetrator of the violence that did take place. Would you concur with that?
Yes. I think if we're going to look in terms of, in the eyes of God, who is guilty, I'd say Mayor Daley is guilty, yes.
You said up there, Mr. Mailer, that you might like to run for mayor of Chicago. Was that a facetious remark?
I wish to bring a little warmth to Judge Hoffman's heart.
Speaking of Judge Hoffman, could you give us your impressions of the judge, perhaps some of the other people in the courtroom, the prosecutor, the thumbnail sketches, like that?
Well, I love to, it's like, in prize-fighting terms, I love the way Judge Hoffman works. You know, he's a very fast-moving featherweight with a marvelous jab that he never takes out of your face. And I think he'd go through 100 fights and never be defeated and never knock a guy down. Except for his marvelous ability to throw those little contempt things around. But what I mean is I give my opinion of Judge Hoffman. He's a distinguished gentleman and asset to jurisprudence.
Would you say that Mr. Schultz was also fast on his feet?
Pretty good. You can't ask me to love a guy who's sticking his thumb in my eye. I thought it was perfectly fair from his point of view, in the sense that, of course, keep me from saying anything that's even remotely interesting to the jury. If you're a prosecuting attorney, then that's what you would try to do. But as I say, I think what's wrong with this whole case is that if the establishment seriously believes that there was a conspiracy, I think they owe it to themselves to try to find out if there was a conspiracy. It's impossible to find out the way they're restricting the evidence. I mean, you really have to enter into what men's philosophies are before you begin to discuss whether this was a conspiracy or not.
Would you call this a political trial?
I would call it a vendetta. To use the French word, it's a revanche.
Do you think the defendants have much chance of being found not guilty or being acquitted?
Well, it's a jury trial, but I think the jury would have to defy Judge Hoffman just about to acquit the defendants.
Mr. Mayor, could you talk a little bit about the investigation of the state of mind by the government?
Well, see, my argument all along has been that for a conspiracy to take place, I'm not talking now legally, I'm just talking about as a human matter, what does a conspiracy consist of? It consists of people getting together in order to make a dent or break or destroy some opponent or some enemy from outside. And the whole notion, this whole new notion in left-wing politics, which I find so stunning and brilliant, which is these kids have brought up and developed, is that that's not necessary. You have minor forces when you're on the left. You don't attack a fortress. You surround the fortress and let the people who are inside the fortress start having nervous breakdowns, and they destroy themselves. And this is why I think that, if you're going to say that's a conspiracy, then you've gotten into something pretty extraordinary in the history of American jurisprudence, which is, that's an extraordinary kind of conspiracy, I think. Say we're going to make faces and let them have breakdowns, and that's a conspiracy. But that's what the issue is about. I mean, is that a conspiracy or isn't it? And all this business about did so-and-so and so-and-so on such and such a day say, let's attack so-and-so, let's kill so-and-so and so, well, that's all fruit salad. I mean, anyone who knows these people, who's lived with them for years, off and on, been in meetings with them, just known them, know their history, knows that it's not their interest in life. They're cut-ups, they're seals, they're clowns, they're men who have a marvelous gaiety and enjoyment of life, and they're going to laugh their way to prison.
You came to the city to express the Justice Department's point of view that there should be negotiations between the city and the National Mobilization Committee, and you met nothing but resistance in your attempts to express that point of view and get it across. Is that a correct statement, fair statement?
We didn't meet resistance. We just didn't meet any activity that would indicate that this was going on.
Well, did you get any understanding of why the mayor didn't want to negotiate?
Yes, he believed that if he didn't negotiate, and people knew throughout the nation that it was difficult to find housing and to demonstrate on the streets, they wouldn't come. I don't think I ever answered the question whether or not they were a threat to the city. I don't think they were at any time.
Were city officials then responsible for the disorders that happened?
One city official was responsible for the disorders that occurred.
Who was that?
Mayor Daley. That should be obvious to anyone who lives in Chicago. Does anyone else make decisions in Chicago besides Mayor Daley? Page 7 of the memo. This memo was comments on what the Justice Department position should be and attitude and involvement in the two political conventions. Under Chicago, I wrote that the primary problem in Chicago at this time seems to be the unwillingness of the city and its police to negotiate with those who wish to and will demonstrate. It is recommended that two things be done at this point. One, Mayor Daley be persuaded that the present policy of non-negotiation must be changed, and that's underlined, must. And two, Roger Wilkins and I go to Chicago to confer with the mayor and Superintendent Conless. Roger and I can go as soon as Thursday, July 25th. Arrangements could be made with Mayor Daley. Our purpose will be to expedite negotiation involving Department of Justice personnel there, the U.S. Attorney, CRS, and FBI, and making evaluations as bases for future action. That's page 7.
As much as you were involved with liaison, you might answer a question that has come up several times during this trial, about which you were not asked up there, and that is, what was the feeling of the Department of Justice about a march on the amphitheater so far as security was concerned, and the Secret Service orders?
We never were involved in the decision. And the question of whether or not there should be a march on the amphitheater.
Did you ever consider this?
We never got to that point. We were considered with much more basic questions, whether there should be effective negotiations.
In your conversations with the mayor, I take it that you found him completely hostile to the idea of negotiating the national motivation.
Mayor Daley maintained that he was negotiating by instructing his city government heads to accept applications made by NMC the same as they would anyone else. I got the impression that Mayor Daley was a man who cared a great deal about his city, but didn't really know what his city looked like anymore.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's a number of things. The idea that all the poor people in the slums and ghettos were going to be content to go to block parties arranged by the city and thereby be happy and play and ignore issues that were on the streets, that seemed to be pretty unrealistic. There are a number of other things. It's just the general impression I have.
You think you should have been allowed to testify about Woodstock?
Oh, I like to talk about Woodstock, but whether it should have been a proper subject of testimony here, I don't know. That's where I met Abby Hoffman. We had a very uneasy truce up there that worked out, and he helped cool some violence that was pretty valuable to us. But he was so good, they thought he was copping out.
Are you still with the Justice Department?
No, I've been in my own business since June the 1st. Hello, Carol. I'm a law enforcement consultant.
Well, I think that the significance of the case has been watered down by the foolishness and, in some instances, lack of apparent seriousness in the case. I think that almost everybody in the nation has a self-interest or a vested interest in the outcome of the trial. I, for one, feel that our whole generation is on trial. New values on trial, different styles on trial. The capacity of the nation to absorb nonconformists as opposed to exterminating them on trial. And I think that that this has been watered down, the significance of the whole trial. I think that it must be made very clear that really it was a trap set up for the blacks, but the whites fell in it. And if blacks had been involved, the case wouldn't even have dragged on this long. But the significance of the whites being subjected to the same kind of brutality is an indication that we knew that racism always existed in the country in terms of the rich whites using the police to suppress the poor blacks, but it was never validated until now that the fascism was of such until the rich white had contempt for the poor black or the poor white or the rich white, but whoever threatened to destroy or to expand the status quo was subject to this kind of brutality. And I think that if one can go back as far as the Civil War, where the North was willing to literally imprison the South, the black and the white, if they chose to secede or to not cooperate, again, that's the same basic principle. They are willing to exterminate or to suppress people again if they're not willing to conform. And I think perhaps the most apparent thing I see is the lack of principles that the nation expresses. The nation, by my way of saying, does not have a philosophy that's moral and sound that it can be consistent with. For example, America is against being colonized, but America's not against colonialism. America is against being suppressed, but America's not against suppression. I think you can trace the basic principles that are verbalized all the time. You can see the radical inconsistencies in terms of things we say and things we do. I think that one of the fundamental things that should have been raised in this trial that was not raised is the kind of what I call the development of the military state to the point where it's no longer a theory, but it's now a reality. We know that without cause, the black community, based upon anticipatory behavior, had trucks, jeeps, machine guns, soldiers drilling in the parks, shotguns with 9 pellets in it, which are pellets that are not even used when you're going to hunt rhinoceroses. I guess that's what they call them. That's a pretty long word for me. But big animals, you know what I mean? They're not intended to kill small animals because the overkill capacity would destroy them. And we've not had a voice to say anything about this. And I think that when one really reflects upon the indifference, perhaps can be expressed graphically when one sees that there are more unregistered blacks in the city of Chicago than in the state of Mississippi. And no matter how you cut it, when you got over 500,000 poor people locked out of the democratic process, that means that they're going to seek another process of their own. Jim Clark had one rationale for not allowing us to participate in the political system. City of Chicago has another rationale, but it amounts to the same thing. Blacks are not in. This can be traced directly to the fact that the top 1% of our nation, population-wise, owns 26% of the wealth absolutely and controls 84%. And the bottom 20% of the nation owns less than 5.4% of the wealth, which means that you have this tremendous gap between the greedy and the needy. Better way to say it is that you have an aristocracy, which has always held fascist regimes. You have an aristocracy under the veneer of a democracy, and because the gap is so great, you need the largest military force in the world just to suppress revolution. And I think that perhaps the worst thing that can happen is that for a country that was born as America was born in revolution, to see that word as some stigma for evil, when the fact is that when you're revolutionizing toward human values, such as people eating and having decent education and health and breaking up racial polarities, that that is a revolution for goodness, the same kind is consistent with Christ. Of course, needless to say, there's a gap in the country between Christ and Christianity, Democrats and democracy, and maybe they really don't even want to change. But this is basically what we found to be a fact. And I think that if this court case does not take into account the state of economic and political affairs prior to the convention, as well as the psychological state, I think that if it's impossible to do it now, but maybe not. I think if someone even ran some psychological tests, even on the attitude of the police before and after, they would see a marked difference just in terms of how they felt before the convention. If they did then a different test on some of the black police who had to stay downtown in hotels and buses because the black police were there to whip the black people, assuming we were going to break up the convention. But once they found that was white, they wouldn't let the black police whip the whites, so they kept the blacks in the police stations in the ghetto playing cards all day and all night without leave and on buses and on hotels. Now, I mean, this kind of evidence, I would hope that at some point before the trial is exhausted, will come out, because if we're moving toward a judicial process where atmosphere and environment, where feelings are not taken into account, where the environment, I mean the social and the psychological environment, is not taken into account, then the judicial process that we were supposed to evolve into with the theory of natural rights and America's tried by your peers kind of court is already gone. Needless to say, as I looked around the jury today, that the kids here, by and large, the persons involved are young. The jury is basically old. They're not the same peers. There are those here who are basically intellectuals who have vision enough to see beyond the temporary, to some extent toward the ultimate, at least toward the future. And you had people in the jury, by and large, who were of the opposite school of thought philosophically. I think perhaps the most humane proposition in our judicial process is a jury by your peers. And here, by comparison, as opposed to a jury of peers, is almost a jury of pairs, you know, by comparison. That's about all I got to say about it. I think that that students all across the country, but adults as well, because you see, I think that if this thing is taken to its logical conclusion, that a minister, you know, like ministers oftentimes attempt to give radical messages to inspire their congregations, can just make an off-the-cuff remark in a sermon and somebody can leave church and do something that's inconsistent with the law, he can be called into federal court. It means that civil rights leaders, no matter how moderate they are, they can make statements that can be later used by some lawyer who's trying to extend his point. They can be brought into court. I think that Southerners always are making provocative statements about people in jeopardy. And I think that if the law is consistent, that many of the statements that are even made on the floor of Congress can be considered inflammatory. And I think the conspiracy can be taken to conclusions that would be the very opposite that America is or even purports to be or even has the desire to be ultimately, if it were as moral as it once thought itself to be.
One last question. You were involved today in a little exchange with Judge Hoffman right at the beginning of your testimony, and you had as much respect as any witness has gotten in that courtroom. Would you relate that opening exchange?
Well, part of it, you know, I was taken back by, you know, the judge's stance and seemingly lack of tolerance. You know, the judge is kind of old. This has been a long trial. So I figured rather than, you know, trying to infringe upon him by trying to be exact, when I saw him smiling, I just kept him smiling. And he told me I was out of place by some statement I had made, and I told him I didn't understand courtroom procedure. I wanted him to help me if he was going to be a just judge. And he said, well, okay, see, I would be out of place in the pulpit, and so both of us smiled. I knew he would. And You know, and so we developed some mutual respect because he was going to give me some instructions about how to operate in the courtroom, and if I ever caught him in church, I was going to give him some instructions about how to be moral. We just kind of had a friendly exchange going. But I think that the reason I chose to take it to that conclusion, I think oftentimes we got some obligation, and I guess this is perhaps the most meaningful point about nonviolence as a philosophy as opposed to just a strategy that always appealed to me. But oftentimes self-examination is the first law of the philosophy, and that sometimes if you can catch your victim and see him as sick rather than mean, then you can apply a certain therapy. And if you react just as he reacts, you have lost your capacity to be therapeutic. So I just saw him as a patient of a sort, and I was convinced before I came in the court that I was not going to allow, you know, his attitude, no matter how it expressed itself, to pull me down to a certain level of behavior. And I think that I tried to follow Counselor Kunstler's questions as closely as possible, and there were some things perhaps that didn't come out, you know, just in terms of Ren and I, in fact, had more than one conversation. And I really think that they attempt to, I mean, even though the judge listened, I was glad he did, I think that, you know, our concept of a patriotism, of a new patriotism, as Ren and I was talking, where, you know, patriotism means doing things in the best interest of the country. And, of course, those things involve peace. And those things involve justice. That I don't think that kind of thing got the play it should have gotten in court. And it's very difficult for me to tell how much, you know, my statement, even though he allowed it to be lengthy, is weighed in his decision. But I think that fundamentally between the judge's age and the jury's relative indifference to any kind of social change, that is going to weigh heavily in the outcome of this trial.
I don't think that you could see it while you were speaking, but when you were speaking about the level of resistance that exists and can be justified in between normal petitioning on the one hand and revolution on the other, when you started beginning to discuss the alternative before you called it resistance, Foran turned to Schultz and in his voice said, "Riot." He thought, and Schultz thought, that your whole testimony was quite funny.
Well, I've always thought that the movement has a resource in the American Revolution which it makes use of imperfectly. And I think somehow we're at our best when we think of ourselves in that tradition. For example, when Oglesby in November 1965 led off his famous speech in Washington trying to imagine what Tom Paine and Benjamin Franklin would have said about the war in Vietnam. Or when Jerry showed up at the HUAC hearing in August 1966 in a uniform of Washington's Revolutionary Army. I have always grooved on that, but trying to prepare this testimony, it seems to me it's relevant in a much more precise way, namely that in that period before the American Revolution, they did not have any kind of control over the officials who made decisions. Therefore, their position, not being able to elect members of parliament, was like the situation of blacks who were not registered to vote, or like the situation of all of us when the nominally democratic government doesn't respond to us. And so in what I wrote, I tried to make the case that what had made people want to come to Washington, to Chicago rather, was the lack of responsiveness of the government over the war issue. And then the flurry of hope connected with McCarthy's campaign and the dashing of that and the realization that it was going to be Nixon or Humphrey. And that What happened in Chicago and where we stand in the country now ought to be seen as very analogous indeed to the position of those cats in the pre-revolutionary years of the 1760s and 1770s.
Well, there's a strange way in which the theme has come up again and again, and in some ways the government implies that they agree with us. I remember in Ferrand's cross-examination of Rennie, he accused Rennie of in the finale of his cross-examination of Rennie, where you're supposed to bring your attack on the witness to a peak, he kept asking Rennie whether he hadn't said that the Viet Cong were in many ways similar to the early American patriots and rebels, and whether he, Rennie, didn't believe that the American government was now doing in Vietnam what the British government had done in the United States. And Rennie, of course, said that he had made those statements. And that seemed to please Ferrand, seemed to convince him. And when Jesse Jackson spoke today, he also, I think, raised the same issue of recovering patriotism, which he defined as doing what is necessary for the survival of the country in the best interests of the people in the country, in the discussion that he had with Rennie. And I think that his testimony dovetailed with yours. His was before the jury. It was as if he knew what you had tried to say without the jury, because not only did he go into patriotism and into the American Revolution, but he said that without a permit granted by the city, then one has to issue a permit to oneself. I think he said a moral permit. When the government is in omission, then you have to commission yourself to take charge of affairs.
When you don't have permission, you have to have a commission from your conscience. But we have just altogether lost the sense of what it means to begin to create a revolution. And if we could recover that sense, then I think we'd come to have a wholly new feeling about those years before 1776.